All right, well, the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation for Monday, May 24th. Thank you for being here. Everybody here, Doug Tindall, the Deputy Director of ODOT, thinks you're all here to hear him, and of course, we want him to feel good, so just pretend that you are. We're going to have just one little thing out of order. We're going to start with the update from the Travel Information Council, then we'll go with the Oregon Arena Project, and then the Transportation Project list. So with that, we'll open up an informational hearing on the Travel Information Council, and ask that Cheryl Gripskopf from the Travel Informational Council come forward. Welcome.
Good afternoon. It's a packed house. Senator Metzger and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Gripsko. I'm with the Oregon Travel Information Council. We are Section 32 and 33 of the Transportation Act, and we obtained management of 9 rest areas on January 1, and I was asked to come and report on our status and how the transition went. So just briefly, once we learned that the bill was passing and that our section was passing, we went out to each rest area at least twice, met with ODOT, learned about all of the unique circumstances in each rest area, and developed a plan of action that included all the facilities upgrade that needed to happen, pavement, sidewalk upgrade, hazardous tree upgrade, and what we would need in terms of on-site staff. And in September, we began recruitment. I'm happy to say that 67% of everybody that we hired were unemployed or underemployed people who have tremendous skills in facilities management and started wildly enthusiastically on January 1 and have an incredible commitment to making those rest areas the best they can be. On January 1, we moved in. We made sure that everything was up and running on that first day and then set about to start doing the things that we could do immediately. And that was replacing some of the fixtures in the restrooms, making sure the maintenance people that we had from the local community knew exactly what they needed to do, and had a basic evaluation form that we're asking people to fill out so that we make sure that our bathrooms are consistently clean and that the visitor is very well respected when they come through. Some of the examples of what we've been able to do in the last 4.5 months is partner with local businesses such as the Dahlia Farm, the Tulip Farm, the Wildflower business, and start planting some of those examples in the rest areas so that people know what they can go into the local community and see and purchase as they come through the rest area. In the Baldock rest area south of Wilsonville, we found a pond that was filled with debris and brush that was removed. It was put back together. It is now a very scenic pond that's filled with turtles and mosquito-eating fish, and people now have picnic lunches next to that pond. We're using juvenile corrections crews to remove invasive foliage and down brush in forested areas, and we're working with locals on some other kinds of hiking trails and recreational trails. In Ontario, a lot of hawthorn bushes and lilac bushes have been removed, and the visitor can now come into the rest area, see what they need to do, know where they need to merge because of the improved landscape. When they went to one section, they found a lot of rabbit bush that had gone up to 4 to 5 feet. When they tore that out, they found a replica of an old freight wagon. So they landscaped that area. It's now one of the top places where visitors are getting their picture taken as they're coming through the rest area. I was there last week, and I had people in the restrooms rave about how clean and how beautiful things look there. In Boardman, we've refurbished water lines for potable water. We've painted picnic tables and restrooms. We've installed 2 dog stations. We found that at the Albany rest area, there was significant amount of dumping right next to the Santiam River, 30 yards from a designated salmon estuary. The kind of items being dumped were environmentally harmful. We put up a big gate immediately to stop the dumping, cleaned it out, and disposed of all of that, and now the boaters are using that for recreational purposes. All in all, what we've found is that the travelers love having somebody there so that when their car doesn't work, we've got somebody on site to take care of that. In Ontario, a couple of weeks ago, a woman couldn't get her car started. The manager drove home, got what he needed, took it back, got her car up and running. She was on the road in half an hour. And we are consistently told that they feel safer with that presence and that the rest areas look incredibly well. We have started coalitions with three rest areas, both North and South Baldock, and also in Boardman. And those coalitions consist of legislators, of mayors, of county commissioners, of visitor bureaus, and economic development people. They're going to set the economic development vision. And so instead of the state deciding what they need, they tell the state what they want. And over the next 5 years, what we hope is to have rest areas that really do serve and showcase what is in our local communities and how much we'd like the visitor to stop and stay a while and spend some money based on what we tell them in the rest area. We're also training our coffee service people in the Q training program through Travel Oregon so that they also can direct people into the local communities and utilize all the businesses there. We have two more coalitions starting up in Albany and in Ontario, and by the end of the year we'll have Grants Pass in place too. The most significant story that's happened over the past 5 months is the identification of 35 people who have lived in the rest areas south of Wilsonville for at least 15 years. They've lived in RVs, in vans, in their cars, and they've become a very tight-knit community, a very close interdependent neighborhood, as you were. When we met them on January 1, their biggest concern was that we would kick them out and they would have no place to go. A coalition of people were formed with the Clackamas County DA's office, Clackamas County Social Services, the Canby Center, Oregon State Police, Clackamas County Sheriff, ODOT, and TIC, and we set a goal that on April 30th, they would not be in the rest areas, and on May 1, we would start enforcing laws and rules, but that every single one of them would have a place to go that was a higher standard than what they knew at the rest area. As of today, 10 to 11 people are in homes. The rest are still going through intake, detox, and rent well classes. And when they're done, the idea is that they will also be in homes within 6 months period of time. So that is actually a very brief shot of what we've been up to. I want to really laud and applaud ODOT because they've been at the table with us. Without them being at our side with administrative rules that we could use for the homeless situation and their consistent counsel to make sure that we're headed the right direction, this couldn't have happened as fast as it was. And we appreciate the fact that you were at the table and gave us this opportunity. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl. Mm-hmm. What would you characterize as maybe the biggest challenge you faced in the last year as you've been undertaking this?
Well, we've only been here 6 months, or 5 months, and the biggest challenge was the homeless situation. I'd say the second is just upgrading the infrastructure. In some cases, that's a little bit older and needs quite a bit of refurbishment and maybe replacement, and then making sure that that's all done in a way that is environmentally sustainable. So we're doing that study and setting an inventory plan for that.
I know one of our more problematic ones has been Baldock for a number of years, and I've actually made a point of stopping in North and South almost every time I go to Salem. So, I mean, I've been there dozens and dozens of times, mm-hmm. and it looks very nice. It looks extremely nice, and you can definitely tell that it's more comfortable for people coming in there. And the comment that I hear and some of the deputies, particularly from Clackamas County that go through there and sometimes Marion County mm-hmm. that I've seen there just kind of drive through is the presence of people really makes a difference in terms of the activities that go on there. And I'm hopeful that with this transition and the work that you're doing, it that will continue to make it comfortable for our guests, whether they be our own citizens or from other states, because they're beautiful facilities if you feel comfortable about it, and they're looking very nice. And I would commend you for that, and hope that we'll be able to continue those presence, because I think that makes a real difference to how everything else works.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. I believe you're absolutely right. That authorized presence tends to disperse anything that has a nefarious intent. The local coalitions actually see those ball docks as having so much potential in terms of hiking trails and recreational facilities, as well as large visitor centers that can showcase products. So a lot of potential there.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Schrader.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for your efforts with Clackamas County. I obviously have a little bit of fondness for the county from my past experience, and I'm glad that you work with the sheriff and the commission, and commend you on working with the homelessness issue. That is a huge, huge problem, and I'm glad that you kind of have this unique partnership. So thank you so much for that.
It's my pleasure, Senator Schrader, and you have very talented people in that county.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. All right, we'll close the informational hearing on the Travel Information Council, open a public hearing on the review of the Oregon Arena Project audit process. Colleagues, you may remember these were this was a project down at the University of Oregon that we, the legislature, authorized up to $200 million in 11F general obligation bonds for the state. And that project is well underway. There has been concerns. I think a number of you have heard about that. And so today I agreed to kind of outline some of those concerns and then get a response from the university on whatever those issues may be. And then the Secretary of State has looked at some of these issues and has agreed to do an audit of this process. So they will be the last one up to respond to the comments they hear today. And with that, I'll ask a representative or representatives from the building trades who have been expressed some of the concerns to come forward and outline what those concerns are. And we'll proceed from there. Welcome. Just identify yourself for the record and your role, and then proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name is John Williams. I'm a researcher for Plumbers and Fitters Union Local 290. I also write for a construction trade journal. I have reviewed thousands of pages regarding the ongoing construction of the $200 million University of Oregon basketball arena. I conclude that a lack of transparency clouds this project. I have provided you documents that were pried out of U of O's reluctant fingers to the state public records law. These are in a blue notebook that's been handed to you, hopefully. Here's some background. Okay. This legislation passed during the 2008 mini session and authorized $200 million in bonds for a new basketball arena. But public records indicate that over $300,000 of this arena funding may have been diverted to a separate project for landscaping at the academic center. You may know that the Oregon University system currently enjoys an exemption from public contracting laws in this state. However, Oregon law does require the Oregon University system to develop its own competitive procedures and exemptions from those procedures when appropriate. When can a university waive competitive bidding? According to the OUS administrative rules, the university president must make a written determination that due to special needs, experiences, or qualifications, only a single seller is reasonably available. Please note these rules say sole source procurement will be avoided, except when no reasonably available alternative source exists. Special needs, like a declared state of emergency, are for unforeseen circumstances. If a water pipe breaks and floods a dorm, U of O can hire the first plumber who answers their phone. But otherwise, a normal competitive bidding process must be built into any construction schedule. U of O had planned for the arena project since 2003, so all involved parties should have been prepared for pre-construction activities to begin in 2007. Not so. Instead, in 2008, the U of O sought approval of no-bid contracts with National Championship Properties, NCP, to construct the arena. U of O's rationale was that NCP's current relationship with an architect and contractor had not been foreseen. This is not a pipe breaking late at night. This project had been planned for 5 years, but U of O's failure to plan a project over a five-year period then became an emergency that justified a no-bid $200 million project. The bond resolution said the emergency is to ensure that construction began in summer 2008. Actually, the construction subcontractors did not even submit bids until early 2009. This resolution also claimed there was no reasonable alternative except to hire NCP, who would contract with the construction and architect firm. And who is NCP, whose construction management services are so indispensable to the U of O? It is a subsidiary of the University of Oregon Foundation, whose board members are generally large donors with little expertise in construction management. In 2007, when U of O first began planning to give the no-bid contract to NCP, U of O could have called up two other general contractors, both of whom bid on the arena job in 2003. General contractors A and B had both offered to build the arena for a construction management fee of 2.25%. If you would, please turn to tab 1 in your blue notebooks. This first page shows contractor A bidding a 2.25% management fee. The next page shows them tentatively agreeing to a total project cost of $125 million. Now that's in 2003 dollars. The next page shows general contractor B also agreeing to a 2.25% management fee and $125 million. That's what happens when you have competitive bidding. The next page is the cover page of U of O's initial no-bid pre-construction contract for general contractor C. This was rolled over later into a construction contract with the same management fee. The following page shows that contractor C's management fee is 3.25%, or 44% higher than the bids of contractors A and B. On a $150 million job, a higher management fee of that amount would raise the price by $1.5 million. I am sure that general contractor C is worth every penny that they are paid, but U of O has failed to document why general contractor C should be paid 3.25% of the project costs when two other companies had offered to do the job for 2.25%. At the time U of O contracted with general contractor C, actual construction was still almost a year away. U of O had time to offer general contractors A and B another chance to bid on the arena. So U of O hired NCP as the construction manager, hired contractors C as a general contractor and construction manager, then U of O awarded another no-bid contract to hire another contractor, another construction manager, JMI Sports, who apparently is not licensed with the State Secretary of State's Corporation Division to do business in Oregon. We have also been unable to find an Oregon construction contractor's license for JMI Sports. The university system must also provide an annual report listing its no-bid contracts. Those reports would provide transparency by showing who received no-bid contracts, but we are unable to find if those no-bid contract reports have been filed and are available. Last August, I requested U of O to provide copies of the change orders on the arena construction job. U of O responded, "The university does not possess documents responsive to your request." This response was unbelievable. I encouraged another person to make the identical request later. The later response by U of O did admit the change orders. Now, I contrast this with the reception I've always got at ODOT. When I've asked them for records, they put me in a room, covered a table with boxes of documents, and said, "Just tell us what you want copied." Please turn to tab 2. This is the cover page from part of U of O's later response, titled Amendment Number 3. The following page, called Attachment A, lists identification numbers, A-so-and-so, for only 6 individual change orders, but they are numbered through A-51, indicating 51 total change orders. The entire text of Amendment 3 is included at the end of your blue notebook at tab 7. The next page in tab 2 is the cover page from another one of the U of O's documents that they finally provided. It is Amendment Number 4. The following page, Attachment A, lists 11 individual change orders. In sum, U of O ultimately provided some details on less than 20 of at least 51 change orders. Now, there was an article about this in the Oregonian. U of O attempted to explain to the Oregonian that they had received no change orders at the time of my request, and that's why they told me they had no responsive documents. I'm sorry here to take some things out of order, but please turn to tab 7A. Hopefully that's in everyone's notebook. First, you'll find a July 2009 letter to U of O asking for payment of arena construction charges. So this is the cover letter from a packet of documents that went to the U of O. The following letter shows that of this billing, U of O physically possessed paperwork regarding at least 3 change orders totaling over $204,000, 2 months before I made my records request. The next invoice from a later billing dated August 11, 2009, 9 days before I made my request. It shows 5 change orders in that billing to U of O, totaling over $11 million. In other words, U of O possessed several change order records prior to receiving my records request. Nonetheless, U of O told me they had no change orders. Transparency in the issuance of change orders is important. Subcontractors could submit a lowball bid and then get more money back by billing for change orders. A high number of change orders can also signal that a project is poorly planned. I do not allege any improprieties took place on the arena job, but when U of O first denies their change orders and then provides only partial information, the process lacks transparencies. Let's turn now to the selection process for the subcontractors. The arena subcontractor process did allow competitive bidding, but it also featured a donation in kind process. A subcontractor apparently could offer a donation, and that would lower their bid. The donation could change a high bid into a low bid and cause a different contractor to win a contract. Please turn to tab 3 in the notebook. And I apologize for the poor quality of this enlarged spreadsheet, but the U of O gave me a poor copy to work from. Hopefully you can read that the highlighted in-kind donation for subcontractor B is for $250,000. That $250,000 is then subtracted from subcontractor B's bid. The following page shows that ultimately after the subcontractors had been required to submit bids on a variety of alternative project designs, subcontractor B's bid of $15,168,700 with a donation in kind already subtracted is now the low bid, and they are awarded the contract. Another copy of all three pages of the spreadsheet follows. Please turn to tab 4. Later, change orders were added to Contractor B's contract. Now their contract amount exceeds the original contract award even after the donation in kind is subtracted. As mentioned, U of O provided poor documentation of these change orders. Only about $46,000 of that $468,000 in change orders for subcontractor B were described in Amendments 3 and 4 that U of O had provided. And again, U of O failed to demonstrate that any donation in kind was actually paid and to whom. And in another separate instance, the public records raised questions about the appropriateness of the change order. Please turn to tab 5. This is change order A51. Here, General Contractor C submitted a change order for exactly $750,000 to the penny billed to the arena project. But the work was performed on a separate non-arena project, the landscaping of the Academic Center Library, but the legislature's authorization of $200 million was solely for a new basketball arena, not for any other U of O projects. U of O responded to the Oregonian on Friday that landscaping of the Academic Center was always part of the arena project to improve the view of the arena for people driving on Franklin Boulevard. But public records undermine the U of O's claims. The simplest response is, if the academic landscaping was always part of the arena project, why do they need a change order to pay for it? Please turn to the next page in tab 6. This is a U of O contract signed July 31st, 2008. The following page shows that another party, in paragraph 5, that another party was obligated to pay that $750,000 for the Academic Center landscaping. The U of O owes the public some transparency on this issue. If the Academic Center was always part of the arena project, why was another party obligated to landscape it? What happened to that signed contract? Did U of O let the other party off the hook? Did the other party renege on a written contract? Please turn to tab 8, which also indicates the Academic Center was never part of the arena project. First is the cover page from the granting of an easement for the arena project. The second page is a site plan map for the arena, the project site description, and the attached site plan map do not show the Academic Center as part of the arena project. It's not even on the site plan. The Academic Center is northwest of East 13th and not even on the site plan. And in the lower right-hand corner, the site plan map that labels the project site does not label the Academic Center as part of the arena project. If the Academic Center was part of the arena, it should have been identified in those filings. The next page is from the contractor's billings from late 2009. It also undermines UFO's claims that the landscaping was always part of the arena project. The landscaping project is listed near the bottom of the left-hand column of the page and is captioned Green Landscapes Fund. This document shows there was no money in the original budget for the landscaping. If there was no money in the original budget for it, was it really always part of the arena project. In summary, I ask the committee to consider changes in the regulations to allow greater transparency into the university system's contracting decisions, to ensure the annual sole source reports are actually filed and made available, and that competitive public works bidding procedures be implemented in the university system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. I have a couple of questions. You pointed out a couple of the higher bids that became lower bids because of in-kind donations. And that's not unusual in the construction world. But you pointed out that you have been unable to receive from the university a description of what those actually in-kind donations were led to that accounting. Is that correct?
Yes. I asked for all the information they had on it. It doesn't say who the in-kind donation is paid to. We don't know if it's paid to the university, to the contractor, to the University of Oregon Foundation. We don't know what form it's supposed to take. Are you supposed to buy $250,000 in basketball tickets? Do you give them a free truck, a free truckload of pipe? There was just no information at all.
Do you call what was the for the project, what was the total project bid? What is the tab that we are expecting for the arena based on the original bid?
Amendment 3, which I provided to you in its full text, at tab 7. The second page, mm-hmm. That was a two-sided, the second page in there shows a price of $150,389,000. Now, that's Amendment 3. Amendment 4, the price was a little bit higher, over $151 million. And that's as of late last year, October of 2009.
Okay.
That's the latest information I have on it.
Okay. And what you've pointed out, Mr. Williams, is how long have you been making public records requests for this project?
Since July of 2009.
July of 2009. And you say they have been less than responsive on just providing that information, or one aware of information.
Yes. I have a good dozen responses still pending and unanswered. And also there's another situation. I asked about Contractor C, said they're going to provide value engineering to lower the cost of the project. So I asked for examples of it. And U of O said, well, as soon as they send us a check for $4,000, and then we'll look for it.
Okay. Questions from the committee for Mr. Williams. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I see a bunch of people out there madly taking notes. I'd imagine they're representatives of the Contractor C, possibly, or the University of Oregon. And considering how much lawyer fees are, I can have a pretty good guess where that $250,000 is going. You know, in this state, it's bad enough we have an attorney general, an activist attorney general that hires activist lawyers to go out and allegedly falsify water samples and get in the way of and run off hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars with a private investment on a utility that we all need, use, demand, and enjoy. But, and the good people that represent the folks that you're referring to in this book are going to get their chance. But I got to tell you, I supported the arena, and I still do. I think it's a great facility. I think it's good that we're supporting our university system and sports in this state. But you know what? A lot of the good people that you work for and that are in this room right now, my brothers and sisters out there building America, they were some of the strongest supporters of this. And then just to dismiss them. You know, it's just unbelievable. And you know what? If we can't keep better records than this, if the university system in general, specifically the University of Oregon, can't keep better records and provide immediate access to records, why in the world do they think me, who has a vote on the House floor, is going to ever trust them to go out and bond for operations? I tell you, I'm not going to. So if what you're saying is anywhere near true, and I have no reason to believe it isn't, I got to tell you, there's been a lot of trust broken here, really broken trust, and that you can't put a price tag on it. So everybody's going to get their opportunity to come up here and respond. I look forward to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions for Mr. Williams, Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you say you don't allege any improprieties, which is kind of interesting to me because I thought you listed quite a number of what I would consider improprieties. But I'd like for you to elaborate on one. That is the National Championship Properties, you said, is a subsidiary of Oregon University's foundation.
Yes.
I wonder if you might explain that to me a little bit.
It's hard to explain. Part of the reason I'm reluctant to allege improprieties is because the university's been so reluctant to provide records that I know I haven't seen everything. But National Championship Properties is made up of the University of Oregon Foundation. But there were newspaper articles. Reporters interviewed the members of that foundation, and they admitted they had no idea how these contractors were selected, even though they're actually the foundation runs NCP. And some of these bills, you'll see they're signed by NCP, and it's signed by the chairman of the University of Oregon Foundation at the time, whose credentials were that of a financial investor, no apparent construction experience. Am I answering your question, or am I?
Somewhat.
NCP was originally set up with the thought that perhaps the university could privatize the construction of the arena. The university began a bidding process. As you saw, two contractors bid on it, and then the process was abruptly privatized and turned over to NCP, who rejected those bidders. But at some point, the university decided they needed public money. The process returned to the public funding and the need for the public bidding process, at which point the university declined to enter into that situation and went the no-bid contract route.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. When they turned back the bids that were there,
July of 2003.
2003?
Yes.
Okay. And so it was after that then that they came through the public process?
Yes, about around late 2007, the legislature decided to issue or approve that $200 million in bonds, which forced the project back into some semblance of the public process.
Mm-hmm. A follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Yes.
So what I guess I really want to understand is, if you feel that you get more response and that there's more transparency, that then you would be satisfied.
Yes.
That's it, Mr.
Senator Starr.
Building on Senator Verger's question.
Please do.
You just said yes if there was transparency, but I look at this and think, why in the world would we not go with competent bidders that come in at a lower price? At the end of the day, these are either donor dollars or in the $200 million 11FPGO bonds, those are public dollars. I'm having a hard time understanding why anybody would be satisfied when you have a public agency that relies on the taxpayers for a significant amount of the dollars that are utilized in the university, that we would be satisfied with answers that are ultimately costing taxpayers and donors a lot more money than otherwise would be spent.
If we were assured that those were the low bidders, there'd be no problem. But we don't know. For instance, they were only a low bidder if that donation in kind was paid. I'm unable to establish it was paid or in what form. And there was another instance where a bidder that made a donation in kind was not low and received the winning bid. Now, I only had a few minutes, 20 minutes up here. I can't keep putting materials out. And then that bid, once you add in the change order, it's not low anymore. And if I can't find documentation to justify that change order, there's a lack of transparency whether that was truly a little bit or not. If they'd done it for 14-7 or the original contract award, yes, no question. But then there's $458,000 added on that particular subcontract. Maybe it was completely up and up, but U of O never provided the paperwork to justify it. I mean, you look at Amendment A3, some of these change orders are very detailed. They talk about, you know, how much
what
the
tab
conduit
are you in,
cost.
Mr. Williams, what tab are you in?
Oh, I'm sorry, that would be tab 7. You turn in three, just turn to the attachment A and go to the fourth page of the plumbing and heating change order request. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have details. They have the labor, they have the materials costs, a description of the project. But that's only for $12,000 of $458,000 worth of change orders. I mean, that $458,000 worth of change orders provided documentation like this, they're only for $46,000 worth of it, by my math. The largest portion of it was not documented in this manner. That's why I talk about a lack of transparency. There could be another document that U of O just decided not to give me.
Mr. Chair, call up.
Yeah, please.
So on what basis is the university not being responsive? I mean, have they provided any kind of explanation of where the rest of the information, the documents you're requesting are, or why it's taking so long, or why are they giving any rational response?
No. And I'd like to illustrate that with another example. I tried to follow up by saying, I made a second request saying, you gave me this document dated February 3rd that showed a bid of a certain amount. You gave me a document dated August so-and-so that showed the subcontractor received a higher amount. Please provide documents which explain why that contract amount increased. They wrote me back and said, we don't know what documents you're talking about, even though they had given me those documents themselves.
And just one more follow-up. Mm-hmm. And to contrast, you mentioned that when you go through a similar process, say, with the Oregon Department of Transportation, how does that process work?
I looked over the contract documents for the Eddyville Bypass, the ODOT project.
Mm-hmm.
I asked...
A difficult one?
Beg pardon?
A difficult project?
Very difficult, yes. They put me in a room. They brought out all the documents, covered up a table much larger than this, gave me a stickums and said, mark everything you want copied, and we'll come back at the end of the day and make sure you're still sucking air and make copies for you and send you on your way. U of O, I have to write and write and wait and wait, and you get pieces, or they ask you for $4,000, or they claim that they don't know what they just gave you a month ago when you try and follow up on it, and it's just not an enjoyable experience.
Thank you. Thanks for your response.
Yeah.
You're
Frater.
Welcome.
When you say, who's the point of contact that you normally work with when you're requesting these documents? Because I want to go back to a little bit to what Senator Verger said. I Googled National Championship Properties because I was also unclear as to what they were. So I pulled them up, and they are a nonprofit organization with a Eugene address. And as I look down here, in care of the name, the officer, director, et cetera, to whose attention any correspondence should be directed, and that is the University of Oregon Foundation. So I think that's the connection that they seem, when you're saying that they are a subsidiary of the University of Oregon Foundation, they seem to be the umbrella, but this is a piece of the foundation. So when you're asking for this documentation, is this the first point of contact for you, this particular subsidiary, and who is that? Because it doesn't. What I'm concerned about is when I had done all this work as a commissioner, you know, we were always clear about who the first point of contact was when we went through these kinds of change orders, and this is sounding to me as if the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. And so is this really being malfeasance with intent, or is it just simply who's organized enough to get you the right documentation? Who is it? Is it these guys? I mean,
Well, my point of contact for Public Records Act responses to the university is the university's general counsel.
Okay, so it's directly to... Okay.
Yes, and that's why I tried to emphasize in my supplemental materials that, yes, NCP is ostensibly separate from the university, but they were actually giving documents to the university to bill for the change order. So the university certainly possessed at least some of these documents.
Okay.
What you're trying to figure out is if one may be NCP sitting on documents and...
But who's on first? Who's the go-to person in charge of the documentation for this? That evidently there are gaps in what you've been getting. That's really the question I have. Okay. And if it's counsel, if counsel's supposed to be giving you the documentation and they don't have pieces of it, who has it? It's got to be somewhere. But in what silo? And I think that's what is confusing to me. You've got this nonprofit under the umbrella of a nonprofit, and okay, there's multiple lawyers, but who's the go-to person? Who's the go-to lawyer that is supposed to be, or individual who's supposed to be in charge of housing and you know, keeping a stable record of the documentation? That's my question.
You want to chime in, Representative?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, I'm just a little small guy in the world, but I have a contractor's license, and I can't drive a nail in somebody's house without a contract. So there has to be, it has to be there, either whomever we're talking about here, whoever you're requesting for information, there either has to be a contract to build something, or they're in violation of the contracting laws. And there's no gray area. So if there's a contract, then it has to be available. And how we got to that contract has to be available, too. If people are doing due diligence with my tax dollars and all these people's tax dollars. So there's no gray area here. It's really simple. Either they have the documentation or they don't. And if they say they don't, then they're. I think, if you lead to the following conclusion, then there's some violation of the contracting law. Now, I don't know which it is, and I don't care, but I'd like to find out. Because when we do find out, if there is a violation, I want to correct it. But clearly, this whole process is a mess. And I'm extremely dissatisfied with people having to come in and beg for information on what's happening with their tax dollars. It should not, that's not how it should be. We need to revisit how these contract, this entire contract process and law and how the university system goes about doing it. But it's either there or there's a violation. There's no gray area.
Any other questions for Mr. Williams at this point? We might have some later, so just I'll have you step down for the moment.
I'll be happy to answer things as best I can.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Let's ask Frances Dyke, from Vice President for Finance and Administration, University of Oregon. We see her signature on some of the documents Mr. Williams has here. And I don't know if you have, it looks like you have some prepared testimony.
That's correct.
And then if it's included in that, that's wonderful. Otherwise, we will want to respond to some of the comments related to the university's responsiveness. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Okay. Well, good afternoon to you all. My name is Frances Dyke. I'm the Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Oregon. Senator Metzger, members of the committee, thank you for providing the opportunity for the University of Oregon to comment on this important project. In fact, I do have some prepared testimony, and I have a couple of other comments as follow-up to the earlier testimony. With me in the audience today are Darren Dealey, who is the U of O's Director of Capital Construction, Craig McVicker, who is JMI Sports' on-site manager for arena construction. The U of O did contract with JMI Sports as a development manager for the arena project, and also Jamie Moffitt, the Executive Senior Associate Athletic Director for Finance and Administration. In November 2007, the Oregon State Board of Higher Education authorized the Chancellor to seek legislative approval during the interim Ways and Means hearings in the February 2008 legislative session for an additional $200 million in Article 11 F1 bond limitation for construction of a new arena to replace an aged facility. A solid majority in both legislative chambers authorized the state treasurer to issue the bonds and the University of Oregon to expend the proceeds of those bonds. Debt service on these bonds is from athletic department revenue. There is no taxpayer money being used to pay off these bonds. There is absolutely no question that this is a high-profile public works project, as it represents one of the largest projects ever undertaken by the university system to date. This would be true in any economic environment, but it is particularly true in an economy where thousands of Oregonians are out of work and the business environment is depressed. The university is pleased to say that this project is on time and on budget, that it provides an average of over 300 jobs per day during a time when the state is experiencing huge levels of unemployment, and that because of the favorable bidding environment, the project has been able to include important components, such as practice courts, that were part of the original proposed design, but not considered affordable when construction started. The contracts for these practice courts were awarded through original bid pricing and not through change order pricing. To date, $121.4 million in subcontracted work has been awarded for the arena. Of this amount, approximately $100 million, or 82.4% of the contract value, has been awarded to Oregon companies. This work has been awarded in compliance with Oregon law and sound business practices. From the inception of this project, we have worked closely with the OUS Chancellor's Office and with the Department of Justice, which has played an integral role in all matters requiring legal review. This project has complied with prevailing wage rules as well as with rules specifically applicable to Oregon University System projects. We are aware of the concerns expressed by members of the construction industry and others, and have met with these parties and worked collaboratively to explore their concerns and to address them as appropriate. We take these concerns seriously, and we are fully supportive of the audit. If the audit finds any violation of law, we will take appropriate corrective action. In fact, the University of Oregon has been in conversation with the Internal Audit Division of the OUS since the beginning of this project to discuss timing for an audit of the project. But both the U of O and the Oregon University System are committed to clear accountability. I would like to take a moment to address a recent headline in the Oregonian which suggested millions of dollars unaccounted for. I am here to assure this committee that the arena project is being managed with expert oversight. JMI Sports, an experienced manager of sports facilities construction projects, has responsibility for ensuring the financial integrity of the project. Through daily and weekly meetings between JMI and Hoffman Construction and others, and through weekly and monthly meetings between these parties and the University of Oregon, all involved seek to assure the people of Oregon that the people of Oregon will receive a project of the highest quality and one that is fully compliant with the laws and with the contract documents. For example, payment applications are evaluated and analyzed by JMI and U of O staff on a monthly basis. Quarterly meetings are held to further review these documents and to ensure that any money saved is returned to the project on a quarterly basis rather than at the end of the job. Monthly construction and status reports are provided to the athletic and central administration at the University of Oregon. We take our responsibility extremely seriously and are pleased to provide these few examples of practices in place to execute this responsibility. I would like to thank you for listening to my prepared testimony, and I would like to address three items that came up in the prior testimony. The first one has to do with what's called a landscaping project on the Academic Learning Center property. I think that there may be some confusion because of the geography of that property. There is a road, 13th, that runs through that property. But in fact, that property is in front of three projects that are ongoing. One is the Alumni Center project, which is due for completion next spring. One is the arena, and one is the Academic Learning Center for athletes. Each of these projects had responsibility for maintaining open space and also replacing services that were lost. The arena has paid its fair share of that. That particular open space was, in fact, a gift to the University of Oregon from the bakery many, many years ago, and one of the conditions of that gift is that it remain open space. Another I would like to address is the issue of the public records requests. Many of you may remember that when the president addressed some of the concerns around the Bilotti situation, he indicated that he would be expecting a greater responsivity from the university with regard to public records. He will shortly be announcing how he is reorganizing the university so that we have a standalone public records office, which will report to the president, and which will have interim staff until permanent staff can be hired. So while it is unfortunate we've had these problems with public records requests in the past, or at least the perception of problems, I believe that President LaRiviere is putting in a structure that will be more responsive to the public records requests. There is one other thing with regard to the public records that I would like to mention, and that is it's the university's responsibility under the public records law to be responsive to the specifics of the request. So we do our best, and we will continue to do our best to be responsive to the specific of the request, but it's also our responsibility to recover unusual costs. And I know there was some comment on the cost of obtaining documents, but I would refer you to those pieces of the public records law. So I am here to answer any questions you may have for me at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Dyke. I do have a few questions. First of all, in your written testimony, you say that the project is on time and on budget. I'm glad to hear that. The budgeted price, though, is $151 million. So, well, rounded up to $151 million. So, am I hearing from you that when it is all said and done, that will be the bond allocation proceeds that will be used will not be in excess of $151,000?
No, you did not hear
$151 million? Excuse me, $151 million?
I cannot answer that question for you right now. I'm happy to get the information back to you.
Okay. And you said someone was in the audience on this, because one of the questions that was brought up by Mr. Williams was saying that JMI was not licensed by CCB to oversee construction projects. I'm not an expert in that area. There's a lot of people in this room and on the dais who are. Is that correct, or is that misinformation, or that was received or not received from CCB or Oregon Secretary of State?
Yes, thank you. Senator Metzger, JMI was not hired to either design or construct the arena. They were hired to manage the arena, and as such are not required to be licensed under that board.
What does management mean? Express my naivety there. What does management mean of the arena project versus
Would it be
term?
Appropriate at this time to bring Mr. McVicker up?
Please.
Yes.
Let's answer the question. And we've got a lot of other contractor experts here, so if we don't get the right answer, I'm sure someone will correct them.
My name is Craig McVicker. Excuse me. I'm the on-site manager for JMI Sports. We are a development manager for the project. It's our understanding we're not required to have a contractor's license to perform the management function of organizing and managing client design and contractor activities.
So what is it you do manage? Explain that to me. You say you're the development manager. So what is your scope of duty?
Manage the athletic department, the facilities group, collectively group, bring those people together to respond to issues as they relate to the project, manage that information flow through the architect and design team, and process that information back through the contractors.
Okay.
Following up on that, thank you. And thank you for your testimony, too. So this manager is actually directly involved in the construction of this project. Is that correct?
I think, Representative Shuffler, it would be good to bring Darren Dealey up as well. He is our Director of Capital Construction.
Thank you.
That's okay.
Welcome.
And, Mr. Chair, you know what? I don't need a long, drawn-out explanation. You know, there's just legislative concepts flying through the air here today. I think maybe we need to add the word manage into our CCB licensing statutes on who's required to be. If you're managing a job site, you better know. You're building a job site. I mean, I've been on a few myself, and this gray area is irritating me.
Well, let's let Ms. Newry respond first,
yeah,
and then,
great.
Then have Senator Schrader.
I have one more comment, too.
Yeah, we'll back to Representative Schopper and then Senator Schrader.
Good afternoon. My name is Darren Dealey. I'm the Director of Capital Construction at the University of Oregon. So responding to the question on the CCB license, a development manager is really a process manager in association with the project. They're moving contracts back and forth, reviewing documentation, making sure submittals move between the contractor and the owner and back and forth. So they're managing the process of the construction. They're not managing any on-site construction-related activities. That's the CMGC or Hoffman Construction in this case. It is not the development manager. They're really there to develop the process of the project and assist on a project of this magnitude, helping us move it forward. And to our understanding as well, that doesn't require a CCB license in the state of Oregon for those functions.
Thank you. And one more comment, and then
please,
one question.
Please
shut up. You know, we backed up $200 million of our bond limitation expanded to help back this up. The fact that it's being paid off without tax dollars, in my opinion, doesn't let anybody off the hook here. These are state taxpayer dollar bonds. So I'm grateful that no taxpayer money is going into it. That's wonderful. But still, I still think it comes underneath my tax dollars, in my humble opinion. My question, Ms. Dyke, when you get this nice office in place for public for records, does that mean that we're going to have a similar experience as the good man at had with ODOT when we approached the University of Oregon? Is that how it's going to work, where you walk in, hear the records, flag what you want to copy, and then we're going to get it to you in a timely fashion? Is that what we can expect?
I was actually Representative Schoeffler, and I apologize if I'm not pronouncing.
No, you're doing great.
Correctly.
Just don't let the beer get warm.
Okay. I was actually interested in that process. One of the things that will be looked at as this new office is created is what's the best way to manage public records. For sure, we need better software to track what's going out the door. I also appreciate your comments on the nature of this public project. I absolutely agree with you. The fact that these are non-taxpayer revenues supporting this project does not in any way relieve us of our responsibility for accountability and transparency.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Schrader.
Well, I'm just Googling away here this morning.
Okay.
So as I pulled up JMI Properties, San Diego Company, is that correct? Okay, San Diego Company. And when you actually have here your role, and I'm just going to read from what I'm seeing here, after the athletic department announced its intentions to move forward with the project, the university selected JMI Sports as a development manager for the new arena, an associated alumni center, and underground parking structure. JMI Sports is now managing the design and construction teams for all three projects. In addition to this development function, support in other critical areas, including facility programming, sales and marketing, communications, and ancillary development. So I guess I'm also a little confused about this management piece because it's design and construction. You're managing it, but at least I want to make sure I'm understanding it. Your definition of management is just managing flow of information. It's not actually on the ground any work directly with the construction piece of it. I guess when I read this, it almost implies to me that you are more involved with the construction piece of it. And I don't think it's intentionally misleading, but you know, maybe I'm just not getting it.
So the response that would be yes, they are managing the process of the design and construction
okay.
and the interaction of communications.
Okay.
They're not giving any direction associated with actual construction activities on the site or design activities within the design shop.
Okay, that's Hoffman's.
Yeah, Hoffman
building.
And
LRB okay.
Response, yes.
But the fact that they add construction teams to me is confusing in this a little
yeah.
bit. It would be an implication to me that there's a little more direct involvement in that. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
So, okay, thank you.
Well, and we will ask the CCB about that
yeah.
after the hearing too. I think one thing that this brings up, though, with just the discussion that we're having here, when you talk about transparency, is like, who do I go to? I mean, and Ms. Dyke, you mentioned requests for public records, and we get those often. We ask for them often, and constituents do, and other agencies do. in terms of being responsive to the question. One of the issues is that, and ODOT was used as an example, on a real positive site, and of course as a transportation committee as well, we deal with ODOT all the time and these types of issues, which we're talking about literally billions of dollars in state bonds for our bridges, and we need to be responsive to that. And they have been responsive to that. If you don't know exactly what it is, that can be also a way to stonewall a request, because if you don't have the information that's clear, it's hard to say exactly what it is. If you don't know what it is that you possess, you just know what you're trying to get at. And I think getting back to what my colleagues were saying, one thing is going forward is going to be very, very critical. And I'm not talking just about the University of Oregon. I'm talking about we have a lot of state projects underway or about to be underway. Is to be able to have that information accessible and transparent, and someone who can respond to what the request is. And if you have incomplete information and you don't have documentation available, then it's very difficult for someone to be able to have the mind read to say specifically what. And I would say, like ODOT, in a good agency process, they would be able to provide what it is that you're looking for, even if you can't specifically identify it because of the lack of information, as opposed to, well, I can't respond because you haven't told me exactly what document it is that I'm looking at that I don't want to have to give you. So, I mean, that's just a part of confidence. The other thing I do want to point out is you mentioned no taxpayer money and are being used to pay off these bonds. That is a hope. That is not a reality, Ms. Dyke, and I think you know that. I mean, that is the plan. I was part of putting this together. I remember as a member of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, I pulled out the letter that I gave them 2 years ago because both Treasury and our fiscal office had concern, and I got the documents here, which was the base case scenario for paying back these bonds based on revenues from ticket sales, from seat sales, from interest off the endowment fund, et cetera. And we hired an outside consultant before we went to the legislature, and they said these were too rosy predictions. And we came back with an adjusted base scenario, of which the legislature agreed, even though our fiscal office was still a little cautious, to issue these $200 million in bonds. Because as general obligation bonds, we have a funding mechanism in place, but it is not guaranteed. I mean, it's going to be fees, and there's associated fees, and you know them as well as I do in front of me, of what are anticipated for revenues. And the endowment is then to be the second tier for interest on that, and we have a prediction, an estimation of what that is, although I would be surprised if the first 2 years, based on any of our portfolios, that estimate of earnings has been realized by the endowment fund. And then the assurance that we were given here, and unfortunately, all the people who made the assurances are no longer there. And so sometimes you can have short-term memory if you have new folks. So just as a reminder, because it was President Frohmeyer, it was your attorney who has now been no longer the attorney for the university, that was just, and then Mr. Kilkenny, who came before us to give the assurances of how these would pay off so that we don't get to the taxpayer of our general obligation bonds, but that responsibility is still there. And that third tier, though, was that the university would pay any deficit. But the fact of the matter is, when you get to the university level, you're talking about the taxpayers, because if they can't provide services or they have to raise fees on students, then it comes back to us to provide the money to fill in the gaps. And we have seen that, for example, with the Oregon Health and Sciences University often. When they don't have enough money, they say, well, we're going to have to drop the School of Nursing, or we can't give money to the poor unless the legislator gives us money in order to meet these obligations. So I just want to be clear, we put in a funding mechanism, and we did this in partnership with the university to provide revenue to pay back these bonds. But at the end of the day, they're general obligations of this state of Oregon, and ultimately, if these projections are not met, then taxpayers would have to meet those obligations to those bondholders. So I just want to make that point extremely clear. I share the view that I'm sure the university does, that this mechanism will work to pay back the proceeds, but at the end of the day, the buck stops with the state of Oregon. So I want to make that part pretty clear. Any other questions? Oh, Senator Starr.
Thank you. And I really appreciate, Senator Metzger, you kind of going through that history, because I voted against this as a senator, and because I didn't trust the numbers. And, you know, I think our staff was concerned about it. And I would also submit, though, that any time that the university as a public institution receives a dollar from anywhere. It's a public dollar. And you got to treat that public dollar, with the greatest respect. And the very fact that we're sitting here today with this hearing should concern not just the university. I think it concerns all of us, the fact that we're having to have this conversation about transparency. The university has been around for a very, very long time. And for the university just now to be trying to figure out how they're going to handle public records requests, it just baffles my mind that, we've built buildings at the university before. There's been processes for a long time at the university, and now we're going to create an office to handle public records requests. Seems to me that hard for me to understand. So I would submit that every dollar, whether it's a dollar coming in at the gate, that dollar was earned somewhere. The dollar's being spent, for an athletic event. But those dollars are once they go into the coffers there at the university, are much like, in my opinion, dollars that come into the Department of Revenue.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I felt rather unpopular the day we voted in Ways and Means because I voted against the $200 million to the University of Oregon, and I'm a sports enthusiast, and particularly basketball. And so I felt really bad. I had grave concerns about the numbers and the ability to pay it back, and I hope that is going to be a concern that I shouldn't have had, but we'll see. I think there are a couple of things. Mrs. Dyke, was the concern about the bidding process, and maybe you're not the one to answer this, maybe you are, was the concern about the bidding process from the very beginning, and then even after the bid was awarded, these concerns continued? I need to understand that. And the other thing is, I'm not sure what JMI Sports really does. Are they there to promote the arena so you're going to be able to raise the revenue? Is that all part of their package? Not just the construction, but seeing that you're able to sustain and keep the arena open and going? So those are my two questions.
I'll ask for a little clarification on the first part of the question. So the concerns over the bid process.
Over the bid process.
Whose concerns are you talking about?
The people involved in the bidding, the people on the fringes, on the outside, in the construction business. Was it a process that had a lot of angst in it from the very beginning?
Talking to the general contractor coming on board?
Yes.
That one's a tough one for me to answer because the NCP portion of that was prior to my existence at the university, so I would be speculating to say how that went.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. And maybe you want to respond to what you actually do.
Well, as I hope you could imagine, it's a large, complex project, and managing the various pieces of the variety of teams that have aspects of the project they're responsible for. It takes a management of all of those efforts to get people to respond timely, respond to concerns that the university may have over the design, be able to get the design to respond to those concerns, and be able to process that through the contractor in order for it to actually get built. Again,
I can also add a little bit to that. So the role that JMI is playing on this is very similar to the role that the Capital Construction Office plays on the majority of our projects on campus. The issue that we had at the time the arena project came to being as a $200 million project is we already had a significant number of major capital projects. And so for us to be able to continue the management of a project of that significant of a size, we would have had to bring staff on to my department in a significant number and able to address that. That would have brought on a number of people that were not experienced within the roles that it would take to address a project of that magnitude, and bringing JMI Sports, who had been the development manager for large athletic facilities before, brought a team on board that had established relationships amongst their team, knew how to run a project, and carried on a lot of the same roles that our office did or does on all of the other capital projects we have. And so our office and JMI Sports are kind of working as a mesh team on this, and they're really an extension of our office in terms of how they function and what they're doing on that project. So I end up having only a few number of people on my staff directly on site versus the number I would have to have if we were completely managing it as a U of O.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Yeah, and so when the arena is finished, construction is done, JMI Sports goes away.
As soon as the arena, alumni center, and parking structure complex there is finished, then their contract is finished. Where I would have had a load of temporary staff or hired permanent staff that I would then no longer have a role for. They are on contract for this specific set of projects, and then they're done.
I would like to just comment, Mr. Chair, that
please,
the percentage of Oregon companies that have been involved, I want to compliment you on that. I'd like to see it higher than 82, and the number of people that are employed working on the arena at the time that we really need jobs is extremely important. So I wanted to comment on both of those. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, briefly.
Yes, Representative.
And I want to thank you for that, too. And that's why I supported it in the first place. But, you know, I got to tell you, if I ever vote for another project that we're going to back with our bonds, it's going to be specifically said in the statute that there will be an Office of Public Records for every single piece of paper that applies to that project, and that it will be immediately accessible to any citizen in this state that wants to look at it. Because you know what? I got to tell you, and it's not unique to this project or you good people, and this is pure speculation. I think there's a lot of conscious foot dragging going on in this state when it comes to things like this. I don't think it's a mistake. I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's because people don't know what people want or they can provide. I think it's on purpose people are dragging their feet. That's what I think. And that, even if there's no impropriety or any laws being broken, it smells bad, it looks bad, it is bad, and it just erodes the trust of the people that we work for. I know one thing, my trust here has been broken. And I tell my little girl all the time, you break your trust with me, you may never get it back again. And that's my message to you. So good luck, and I hope we do a better job of providing good citizens with information when they come forth and ask for it. If there's nothing to hide, of course.
So, Representative Schaffler, one issue that I would like the group to understand, I think, is within the last legislative session or the previous one, there was a rule change associated with public records requests that a single office within any of the institutions was required to kind of direct and process public records requests. Previous to that, people came directly to given offices for responses. And as Mr. Williams indicated with ODOT, the process was throw the box on the table, tab what you wanted, we'll make some copies, we'll figure out how much those copies are, what our time is, and it'll be addressed. That process changed with that legislative modification, in which case there was a single body on a given campus. The determination was at that time that our legal counsel was that. And so everything is filtered through that single source now, which I think Senator Starr made comment to, that you know, having the right information and understanding what it is you're being asked about, that was brought up earlier, is an issue. And I think it's an issue as well with the people asking for information in terms of what it is they're exactly asking for and getting what they want. Oftentimes they're not the same thing.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
So you're suggesting it's our fault that you all couldn't come up in a timely fashion to provide that gentleman with information?
I'm suggesting a recent change has modified the process in which hasn't allowed for it to be very efficient, and this is the first major public records request group of information that we've been asked for. So we are stumbling over that a little bit.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, I'm not buying it. I'm just not. All right? You got a bunch of smart people out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not buying that change has made a stumbling block for his public request for information. I'm not buying it. I don't believe it.
I have a couple questions. And since the gentleman from JMI is here and talked about your role of managing the project, maybe you can answer the question. It sounds like you are the appropriate person to ask the question that I asked of Ms. Dyke, and that is because her testimony was that we were on time and budget, and we're pretty far down the roll of this arena now. So can you tell us that the $151 million bid price, in fact, will be the total cost very close to this arena when we see how many bond proceeds are actually have to be applied?
We believe that that is an accurate number at this moment in time for the cost of construction.
So I'd like to add a clarification of that. That is a direct construction cost. That is not overall project cost. On top of that, $151 million is also architects and engineers' fees, permit costs, other associated costs with construction. So the targeted dollar value for the project is the $200 million total. The direct construction cost with Hoffman is $151 million and change.
So fees and permits are $49 million?
There's a long list of items that are not direct construction associated with any given construction project. But
well,
yes.
I understand. That's 25%. So, okay, that's good to know. One other question I had for Ms. Dyker, I was reviewing the legislative fiscal review of the project with the adjusted basis. This goes to paying back this project. The debt service, the assumed pro forma schedule is $15,392,000 for this particular part of the project for debt repayment. You have all the year-by-year estimations of what the revenue will be. So I assume your office, because two of those years have already passed, well, 1 year has passed, and the other one we are mid-year in. Are you updating those numbers, and does the estimation for the first year, 2011, which is the net revenues that are listed for the arena operating revenue, which is $11,528,000, are you updating those? And are those numbers that we have from legislative fiscal still the numbers? Are they less? Because obviously, that's if they're not, then we go to the next tier of funding for the project for the debt service.
I monitor several things, and I also work collaboratively with the Department of Intercollegiate Athletics to monitor their finances. And while it might be tempting to call Jamie Moffitt up, I should point out that she's only been in her job in this new position for 3 weeks, so I'm not expecting her to be fully versed in the arena at this point. But we do monthly reporting. I also and I get monthly reports from the University of Oregon Foundation with regard to the gifts and donations to the Legacy Fund and the earnings on those funds. We compare it to what's required. We compare that to other revenues in the athletic department for the operations of the athletic department. So it's a $70 million operation out there if you don't count the capital construction project. So we do believe we have a structure in place at this point that will help us monitor that going forward.
All right. Because obviously those revenue projections are going to be critical. Can you tell me whether the corpus of the endowment fund has had to be dipped into for the first 18 months to pay for the bonds that were issued?
Well, the debt service.
Well,
I don't have that schedule in front of me at this point, and actually I don't know if there's anyone here that has the exact answer. I do not believe we've drawn on the...
Okay.
So, happy to get that back to you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. We're going to ask Gary Blackmer from the Secretary of State's office to come forward. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Metzger.
And before you begin, I don't know if you have prepared testimony, but obviously, and one reason I asked you to come last so that you could hear what the concerns were, and I think one of the key questions will be confidence in the committee that the concerns that have been addressed here will be encompassed in the scope of your audit.
Yes, so, and actually I don't have prepared. I came to listen as well. Let me give a quick overview of how we've proceeded in terms of developing an RFP to look at this. We were interested in this topic when it came to our attention, but we simply didn't have the resources to go into it in an audit context. We're working right now on three other audits that are at the request of the legislature. So we are extremely busy on those, and we would have had to suspend one of those to pick this one up. So I spoke with Patty Snipkowski, who's the director of the internal audit for the Oregon University System, and she was also interested in having this looked at. And I have to say that she and Daniel Lambert have been highly cooperative and highly professional around this project, because from their standpoint, they were willing to work with us on coming up with a solution. So what we agreed upon was that we would draft an RFP to hire some national construction experts to come in and look at the full range of issues around this project. So what we've done is we've drafted an RFP. We had several meetings to discuss it, and from our standpoint, it covers everything that we thought was most appropriate to look at in this project, and it covered all the major points that were raised today as well. In addition, we were able to set the scope and objectives of this RFP. We will be we will have the final decision on who the national expert is in terms of this construction audit, and we'll also be the primary contract for that expert throughout the course of the audit in terms of project, progress for the audit, as well as the audit results. So, in terms of the topic areas that came up today, we have several. Oh, I should say that the RFP actually is out on the University of Oregon website as of today, and we are seeking out the very best proposals from nationally in terms of looking at this issue. If you were to look at the scope of work that's set forth here, we have several areas, several angles looking at the sole source issue in terms of what we're asking the consultants to look at. We're asking them to look at any opportunities for improving methods and procedures as they relate to contract terms, bidding and selection procedures, and it goes on to a number of other areas. In addition, evaluate the extent to which U of O promoted competition by encouraging the participation of Oregon-owned businesses, emerging small businesses, et cetera. Determine the nature and effectiveness of UO's outreach measures in this regard. And then lastly, identify any improvements that UO could apply in future projects to obtain best value for public funds, to ensure fair and responsible practices, and to achieve other public goals. So from our standpoint, that last one especially is the broadest kind of a question that we could ask, which is asking these national experts, what are some of the best practices out there? Are there things that you saw that could be improved in terms of the processes? In terms of change orders, we have an issue around determining whether change orders are appropriate and properly priced. If inappropriate change orders are identified, determine whether the subcontractor's bid amount plus the amount paid for inappropriate change orders exceeded competitive bids submitted by other contractors. And then lastly, in terms of the subcontractor selection process, well, that covers that as well in terms of just the process that they go about. There is another one. Review the inclusion of in-kind donations in subcontractor bids, determine what the term in-kind donation refers to in this context, and it goes on to ask another series of questions about those in-kind bids. From our standpoint, we think this gives us the full latitude and the full scope of what could be looked at in terms of all the issues around this contract. All the questions, I think, can be raised, and you know, my hope is we can answer all of them. Some of them may be more difficult. We get into the hypotheticals, what if this versus that, and so there are some questions that may not have answers, but we are certainly going to ask our national experts to get some answers to those. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we propose here.
Questions? Yes, Senator Schrader.
What's the estimated cost of all this work you're going to do with the RFP? I mean, your time as well as
We haven't worked that out yet. I'm not entirely sure what the bids were going to come in at. We've probably put our office probably 80, 100 hours into it at this point.
Okay.
Among us. I'm not sure what internal audit in Oregon University System has put into it at this point, but at this point, Oregon University System has agreed to pay for the national experts also.
Okay.
So it's something that, from our standpoint, we feel like we're in the catbird seat in terms of being able to define what is going to come from this contract.
Okay.
Can I just make one word of caution? And you've been around this business for a long time, Gary, is that I appreciate that the OUS is going to help pay for this. But you're always worried about arm's length when someone's paying somebody for their study, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so, and I assume nothing less than your office will maintain a total independent view of the ongoing processes. Because I think, and my own thing is, this goes way beyond this project, and my particular interest in this is much broader, and that is we have been doing, in this committee in particular, has done billions of dollars of transportation contracting, and our ability in this last session of the legislature, 2009, to pass the Jobs and Transportation Act was because that we delivered, as we said we did, on the Oregon Transportation Investment Act of 2003 to rebuild bridges. And we did the bridges we said we were going to do, we did it for the money we said we were going to do, we hired the people we said we were going to do, And we provided value that convinced this body to go even further and provide additional revenues for important infrastructure. And as we look at the infrastructure needs of this state and what the future legislatures are going to be looking at for this, the ability to provide that authority is really going to be based on the confidence of all the processes involved. And so I believe that your report, more than looking singularly at this particular project, will hopefully provide a best practices look for all of our state agencies and all those who seek their general obligation bonds or other bonds that we issue from the state, procedures that are clear, they're black and white, they're crisp, they work well for the state or affiliated entities, other governmental agencies, and those who seek to do business with the state or those agencies. And I think this is a tremendous opportunity in your conclusions to be able to illustrate what those best practices are and what the expectation is, so that we don't have these types of things develop in the future. And I think that would be the ultimate goal that would be valuable. Representative Shockler.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm right behind the arm's length thing, independent study. When you do find someone to do this and you have the contract out there for them, there won't be a clause relating to in-kind donation in there, will there?
I can assure you there won't.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the Secretary of State's Office, Audits Division? Okay, thank you. That's our invited testimony. I will take a few minutes if anybody in the audience wants to provide testimony on this issue. I would invite them to come forward now. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next issue in our agenda. Is there anyone in the audience who has any comment would like to make? If not, we'll close the public hearing on the ARENA project, and thank you for coming. We'll now open a public hearing on the status of House Bill 2001, the aforementioned Jobs and Transportation Act, with Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. He's probably trying to swim upstream in the crowd that is going outstream.
Yeah, I suspect that.
Chair, I'm skipping out for 1 minute.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mike, for coming.
Okay, thank you.
I got real bad. Electric.
Yeah, now we know why everyone was here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to put us in recess? All right, we'll reconvene the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation and ask Mr. Doug Tindall to come forward with a review of our 2001 Transportation Act.
Thanks, Chair Metzger. Members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Transportation. Good news for you today on the construction in the upcoming construction season on Oregon State highways. Thanks to the leadership shown by the governor of the legislature, and in fact, in terms of the stimulus money, the president and Congress, there's a lot of work going on in Oregon and a lot of people employed in Oregon. So my thanks to you, both from ODOT and as an Oregonian, for the things that you've done in order to enable us to have a construction program this summer that's going to pay out over $1 billion to private sector contractors and is going to result in the employment of over 12,000 people that, but for this work, may not be working. And you should pat yourself on the back, I think, for the things you've done to make that happen. I'm going to go briefly over just a couple of the areas where those jobs are coming from. The jobs, and most recently, the Jobs and Transportation Act passed just last year. We don't have a lot of work out of that particular bill yet, but we do have some that's coming to fruition. And the projects named in that bill are all being worked on. Some are at points where they're ready to be out to construction already. Some need some design or environmental work or other activities to occur first. So that will play itself out over future construction seasons. But as you can see in my testimony, there are some projects that are already, in fact, one is already complete, and others are underway and under construction this construction season. The Oregon Transportation Investment Act, and it says OTIA 3 in the testimony, mostly because OTIA 1 and 2 are pretty much done. We're wrapping things up, although they're still providing some jobs. But OTIA 3, still a pretty big year for bridges, but pretty much the last really big year for bridges as we see the completion of that program. The last set of bridges from OTIA 3 will be under contract this summer, and that'll put everything that we're doing under OTIA 3 under contract. A couple of the projects will continue to have construction seasons that will go out into the future, but that is providing a lot of jobs this summer. And the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the federal stimulus dollars that came to us, we got a lot of that under contract and provided a lot of work last summer. The rest of that will play itself out and provide jobs during this construction season. So there's a lot of things going on Oregon's highways and a lot of Oregonians at work because of that, those things that are going on. Also want to add sort of a different type of job creation that's been done through Connect Oregon, where one of the selection criteria is the number of jobs that are created or sustained as a result of the Connect Oregon projects. And Connect Oregon 1, largely complete, not quite complete yet, but over 2,000 permanent jobs, not so much in the building of the project itself, but in what the project will result in. Similarly, Connect Oregon 2, not as far along, but many under construction, and a couple are complete. Several are complete already, and that too is going to provide jobs long into the future. Connect Oregon 3, we're in the process of doing the project selection for that, and those projects will start sometime later this year, and again, we'll provide jobs during the project, but importantly, in Connect Oregon, we'll provide jobs after the projects are complete. So it's a great summer. It's a great thing to have people at work that wouldn't otherwise be at work, and also with the attendant benefit of strengthening Oregon's transportation system throughout the summer. There's a map I've included of all of the road construction projects that are going on. So as you travel around Oregon, again, pat yourself on the back because you largely made this possible. And drive carefully through those construction zones. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tindall.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Tindall, for your testimony.
Sure.
Fantastic. I love this map. I don't know where the camera is. But I want the world to see the map. All those orange dots are highway projects.
Yes.
And those highway projects are funded by Oregonians' highway transportation dollars. They pay at the pump primarily for the gas tax, and then the heavy trucks pay the weight distance tax.
That's correct.
So is it fair to say that there's a lot of construction going on around the state today, this summer?
I think if, as you look at this map and see all those orange dots, and as you drive down the roadways and see all those orange cones, I think it's definitely fair to say that there's a lot of construction going on this summer.
So that's asphalt that's getting spread. Those are bridges that are getting repaired.
Yes,
those are culverts that are being replaced.
Yes.
Those are guardrails.
It's a combination of all those things, Senator. Every piece of that.
So let the record show that not all the highway dollars go to bike paths.
Well, you know, a couple of things on that. I think it's important, especially because people in the committee understand this, but speaking to those who may see this or watch it later, is for future legislators, is to understand the importance of maintaining our transportation system. You talk about the biggest construction year for OTIA 3 is this year. It's 2010. Right? We passed this legislation, colleagues, 7 years ago. So when you think about the difficult situation our economy is in now, we see in the headlines, one out of, what, five Oregonians is on food stamps, et cetera. If it wasn't for the vision of the legislature 7 years ago and saying, well, we have to have something today, it's only today, we don't think about tomorrow, you know, then 7 years later, which is now a very difficult time, we've got thousands of people working because of action that was more long-term horizon. And this committee and the leadership to my right here has been a big part of that and will continue to be a part of that, you know, continue that with Connect Oregon 1 and 2 and 3, and then the biggest projects ever with Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009, of which a future legislature in 2016 and 17 will be hearing this is the biggest construction year ever of JTA, and why it's really important to have a long-term horizon, that we just don't fix things 1 year. That's an ongoing, and I hope with the reputation that the department and the legislative leadership in transportation has done over this last decade will continue, and they'll realize that as bad as things are now, we need to plan for infrastructure and for jobs 5 or 6 years from now. And if we do it right and we keep that investment on an ongoing basis, then every year we're making investments and we don't have those big gaps that I remember Senator Starr and I talked about in 2001, where 10 years hadn't done anything and trying to make up for it. So that map is very important, as Senator Starr pointed out, but it also shows a lot of that map was actually put into motion over 7 years ago for those. I have one question that I want to ask specifically to JTA going forward is the discussion that we had the language in the bill regarding Cornelius Pass Road.
Yes.
Can you update me on what is being done in that process to get us to a long-term fix with some of the ideas that we threw out in terms of, you know, getting requests for proposals, et cetera?
Chair Metzger, I can't remember the exact timing. That procurement is underway. What we did is we pulled together work that had been done by Multnomah County, mostly the county itself, in looking at some potential hotspot fixes and those sorts of things. But then following the direction of the legislature, we're going out for a contract, and I believe it's still to bring on more than one firm to bring us proposals for of ways that we could attack that problem. The question the legislature asked, or my understanding was, what is it we can do? What are some strategies that we can do in a cost-effective manner to fix this problem of Cornelius Pass Road? And so I'm sorry, I don't have the exact schedule on that. I can get that for you, but that is underway, and I believe the procurement is out currently.
Another question. Thanks again. This, again, specific to the JTA. I understand that there's some projects that are out for bid and getting ready for construction this construction season. I understand that the bids have come in some cases, significantly less than what was allocated specifically in the legislation. That's part of the danger of specifying dollar amounts and projects and bills and legislation. But what is the plan for the department, particularly when you look at the Sunset Road a three-lane expansion to 185th. My understanding is that project came in $10 million approximately.
Yeah,
I
think the bids were the construction authorization, when you add the contingencies in, was closer, but it's around that number, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously there's some additional dollars there that are available, and yet my understanding is that the department's hands are tied to a certain extent as it relates to those specific dollars for, you know, that stretch of highway. I'm interested in how the department can be creative. You've already got construction machinery, personnel out there on that particular project. Does it make sense to allocate those dollars in some other fashion? Come back to, does the legislature need to convene? Is it something that the emergency board can take up? Again, it seems like, from my perspective, it would be good just to keep laying asphalt as far out as that $10 million would take you. But again, if you could talk a little bit about what the department's thinking about how to address that.
Sure. Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, the way the bill was written, we've been advised by DOJ, the way the bill was written, the guidance in the bill specifies boundaries of a project and amounts of money. And we don't have, without subsequent legislative action, the ability to spend outside of that boundary. Within that boundary, if there was something that could be done, in doing a highway project, you'll go out and a lot of times, and particularly with JTA, you've got X amount of dollars and you'll size a project for that amount of dollars. And that may mean that some things come out of a project. I don't know in the particular 185th Cornell case whether that's happened or not. But we do have the latitude to spend the dollars within those boundaries. Any money not spent within that boundaries has to come back to the legislature to be reallocated. We can't go, because of the way that bill, the law was written, we can't go outside those boundaries and we can't change those dollar amounts.
Mr. Chair, does that require the legislature to meet, or is that something that the E-Board has any jurisdiction or any ability to weigh in on?
My understanding, Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, my understanding is it would require require legislative action.
Any other questions on this part of the topic with Mr. Tindall?
So, yeah, I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead. Please, no.
So what happens to that? So the extra money just sits. How does that? I mean, you're cash flowing this anyway, so I assume you're not selling the bond, or you're not until you need the dollars.
Exactly.
So that capacity is still there.
That's correct.
Okay.
Exactly right.
Okay. Any other
questions?
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll close this portion of the hearing and reinvite Mr. Tindall forward to discuss the flexible federal funds for non-highway transportation.
Thank you again, Senator and members of the committee. Still Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And this topic has to do with monies that became available, again, because of action in the Jobs and Transportation Act, where money was allocated to the Oregon Transportation Commission to ensure that highway projects that were planned could indeed continue and still take advantage of what are called flexible funds, often referred to as flexible funds or service transportation program, federal service transportation program funds. So we did that. The commission just acted on this last week, and I'm going to describe to you how the commission is going to go about allocating those funds that are now available because we're able to complete the highway projects with new funds from the Jobs and Transportation Act. I usually mess up when I do those things, so I'm just going to walk you through this this handout. I just covered the overview, so we're on page 3. Just a couple of things to highlight here. While these are flexible, they're flexible in the sense that they can be used for more than just highway purposes, but not everything is included. Bike ped projects, transit projects, those kinds of things are eligible, as is transportation planning, which is important because of the work that we need to do, other parts of greenhouse gas modeling and the land use modeling as it relates to transportation that we need to do for House Bill 2001, House Bill 2186, and Senate Bill 1059. That's why that's on there. But this is the complete list of what those funds can be used for. Importantly, unlike the stimulus funds, which had a very broad broad utilization ability, boy, that's horrible. They could be used very broadly for a lot of purposes.
Okay. He's a short timer. Yeah. We'll cut you a break.
Anyway, you could use it for a lot of stuff. How about that? And we had rail projects, and we have port projects, and transit operating expenses, I believe, general STP funds are not eligible for that use. And then one other note, that part of these federal flexible funds are congestion mitigation air quality funds, and they can only be used in non-attainment areas where the air quality is not attaining the federal standards, and there are seven of those areas in the state. That's not the majority of the funds, that's just a portion of them. On page four, we talk about $106 million a year, which includes that CMAQ money I just talked about. That's the STP funds that flow to Oregon. There's a federal mandate to pass those funds through, pass a portion of those funds through to the transportation management areas, which are the big metropolitan planning organizations, Portland, Salem, and Eugene. That just comes off the top. We have no control over that money. It just comes through this and goes directly out. And then there's allocation by agreement to the cities and counties, which is a continuation of a long-standing federal allocation. So on page five, to walk down this list, we have the money coming in. We have the federally mandated distribution. During the session, there was a lot of discussion about 10% of the available funds going for elderly and disabled. And the commission said, we want you to calculate that 10% at as high a level as we can calculate it, as high a level of the funds that come to ODOT. And so that's what's shown here. And then the second line under legislative intent, where it says elderly and disabled transportation not included above, when the legislature approved the Department of Transportation budget, they actually approved a number greater than that 10% amount. And it is very close to 10% of the total amount of STP funds that come to the state, even including those that go directly to the TMAs. Then there's some money for, as I spoke of before, for the implementation of House Bill 2001, 2186, 1059. And then towards the bottom of this sheet, you'll see the OTC direction and the amounts that they've allocated. And what we're talking about here in terms of dollars, the commission said, well, we have commitments now for a lot of these things and in this biennium, and we want to continue and uphold those commitments. But starting in 2012, a committee, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, should look at all of those funds that are going out today and really say, is this strategic? Is this a good alignment with our strategies? Or should we be looking at a different place to send these flexible funds? So for the first 2 years, if you look, the next to last line, available to be flexed by the OTC, for the first 2 years, that's about $21 million that's remaining for this biennium. And then beyond that, the commission is asking for broader input, or input on a larger number of dollars, somewhere around $28 million a year. On page six, the guidance that the OTC gave to the advisory committee, again, the eligible uses, that I want to stress on the applications from governmental entities. This doesn't mean that all of the money has to go to governmental entities. It can go to the private sector. It's just that it has to go to a governmental entity who can then contract with the private sector if that's what they choose to do. So it's not, when we say it that way, it's like our construction contracts. The money comes to ODOT, but we contract out with the private sector. They asked that the criteria include project readiness. We've got some timelines associated with this, at least this first amount that it has to be obligated by September 30th of 2011. They asked for geographic equity, asked the committee to consider geographic equity, and that not necessarily in the sense of dollar amounts, but in sense of making sure projects get spread around. The observation the commission made was that sometimes in rural Oregon, you can do a relatively small project that has a huge benefit. And rather than try and fix certain dollar amounts, they just wanted to make sure that every part of the state was getting some sort of project that was some sort of non-highway project that was improving that part of the state. Project size, just a minimum, maximum, and then really importantly, measures of program effectiveness and outcomes. A challenge to the committee to say, look, if we're going to make allocations to these different initiatives or these different projects, we want to know what the outcome is, what's being generated as a response or as a result of this project. And they asked that the committee recommend those kinds of what outcomes you could look at, and they asked that they recommend what outcomes you should be looking at for the ones for the dollars that are currently flexed out. The membership is shown on page 7. As you can see, it's a very broad array of folks. The commission was very interested in having a full vetting. I just want to call your attention to the very last bullet where it says a safety representative, and that's there because one of the current uses for these federal flexible funds is enforcement in work zones. Which you can't do with state gas tax dollars. And so we want a safety representative to represent that portion of the funds and talk about and also what outcomes are we getting and achieving out of that. The last page shows a pretty aggressive timeline to bring these people together and get a project list approved for the first, the 2010-2011, and then the commission will have further discussion about how to move forward 2012 and beyond, and whether or not they want to talk about a larger sum of money or larger amount of money, that whole $28 million. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tindall. Questions for Senator Berger?
Yes. Doug, in looking at the committee, you know, there's a possibility that there would not be one coastal representative on the committee at all, with Highway 101 being one of the major transportation connections in Oregon. The only possibility of that would be if that rural city would happen to be, which it probably would not be, but would probably be in eastern Oregon. So I would just raise that as an issue.
Chair Metzger, Senator Verger, that's a good point. There are actually three opportunities. You have a rural area commission on transportation. You have a rural county and a rural city. But I think your point, though, is valid, and as we work with our partners in the cities and counties, we probably ought to make sure we get those four representatives that they have from different parts of the state. I think that's an excellent point.
I would really appreciate an effort being made in that balance. I just think that it's helpful to have someone from the coast on the committee.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Drive less, save more.
Yeah.
Is that funded through these dollars, or if it's not, can you talk about where we are in that process and if that contract has been re-let?
Yes, I can. Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, Drive Less, Save More is, if you go back to the chart on page 5, transportation demand as portion of, I think, most of the transportation demand management that's shown under OTC discretion. And that project was held up pending what the OTC was going to do with those flexible funds. Now that they're going to continue on, at least for the next 2 years, the discussion that we had at the commission meeting, I talked to a couple of Washington County representatives. We're going to move forward with that contract. We may just have a 2-year contract with an option to extend as the commission continues its deliberation. But I believe that will be it probably already has by now been restarted again.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Tindall? You're going to leave us at the end of June. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, since this committee will not be meeting again until September, I want to thank you for all the great work that you have done on behalf of the department, and being the guy under the gun for almost every legislative presentation and question. It's a very difficult job, and you've done it very well. Appreciate your service. And as a private citizen, while you will not be obligated, I think this committee, because like you, I won't be here next session, but I think this committee would benefit from your thoughts about transportation, how we might do things better, what are some of the issues you see. So after you leave the department, you know, maybe in the fall, any insight that would be helpful from your years of experience, I think it would be very, very beneficial. I'm sure you'll be asked that within the department. I think the legislative branch would also have great value by your insights of how we might interact better on these issues. So thank you.
Thank you. 32 years.
32.
Yeah. So anyway, but thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Senator Schrader.
So, Mr. Tindall, since you're retiring, you can finally tell us what you really think. Okay. That's glorious.
Really, to put it shortly, briefly.
Chair Metzger, Senator Schrader, let me do that. I appreciate your thanks, but I also want to thank you. I think that, you know, the folks that serve as elected officials, you're not getting rich being an elected official, and the hours that you people put in and the amount that you care about this state is truly admirable. And so my thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
Nice to see you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tindall. Thank you very much. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.